I'm Mary Poppins, y'all. It's time for the Film Threat Podcast. Welcome to the show. I am Chris Gore, joined as always by my co-host, Anthony Ray Bench. How's it going, Anthony?
It's going pretty well, Chris. How's it going for you?
It's going well. I'm sitting here. We're at a restaurant on the west side, just having gotten out of a screening of Alien Covenant. I'm joined by our guest today, filmmaker, producer, has been involved in some amazing things like the restoration of the Blade Runner Final Cut, the Alien. You also did the Alien.
I didn't do the Alien.
You did.
But I produced the Alien Anthology Blu-ray set and the Prometheus Blu-ray set.
Which I happen to own. Welcome to the show, Charlie De La Zarica.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I should say we're at a restaurant. We ordered a round of drinks. We ordered food because we just got out of a screening of Alien Covenant, which we'll talk about at the end of the show. But I want to launch right into it because just we were so busy this week, we didn't get to do a podcast. And I thought, well, let's wait. We're going to see the screening of Alien Covenant on Cinco de Mayo. It is Cinco de Mayo today, which of course means that I'll be drinking my normal drink, which is a Coors Light. So that's, and they're not even our sponsor. But I want to launch into it, and first before we actually talk about movies this week, I want to talk about the Scum and Villainy Cantina. I've been twice. Charlie, you and I went with a group of friends, and I love this idea of immersive nerd culture. I think maybe the night that we went was kind of an off night. Still a lot of fun.
Well, it sounds to me like you had a lot of fun on the second trip.
We had a lot of fun. It was first of all, it was a Saturday night, and it was packed with people dressed up. Like,
because when we went, I think maybe our expectations were too high because I was very disappointed that first time, and it had nothing to do with like I think they did a good job building that bar out to look like the cantina. I think the enthusiasm was there. Just the execution was a bit rough because the music really had no connection at all to Star Wars. The lighting had no connection at all to Star Wars. There was no one there in costume, really. One of the bartenders, she had Vulcan ears on. So it was kind of like cross-genre, cross-franchise. And I thought the bar reminded me more of the bar in Outland with the naked dancers and the techno music. It was like more like that than Star Wars to me.
Yeah, on the night we went, like, I was kind of bracing myself for disappointment because I read the reviews, and, you know, on Facebook it's interesting, like, just a little footnote. Like, I know the guy that's the proprietor of the bar, and all the reviews that were positive that I was reading early on were people that we knew mutually. So I was like, oh, okay, like, he's getting his friends to write positive reviews. Every other review, though, was just like, this place sucks, it's not worth the money, it's awful. I went in with that mentality, and it pleasantly surprised me. I had a really good time. The atmosphere was really cool. The drinks were good. I loved the drinks.
Was it as crowded when you guys went? Because when we went the
packed.
First time,
it was packed.
It was to capacity.
We
couldn't even, like, sit down.
Well, we were lucky enough to get a seat, which was, I mean, it's really a fun photo op, but it brings up an interesting question, you know, the Scum and Villainy Cantina, these sort of pop-up, events, right? There's a Tim Burton restaurant. What's the Tim Burton restaurant called? I forget. But there's you have to know about it, make reservations, and it's a limited number for a limited time. There's also the art exhibit that you went to. You want to talk about that recreates the final scene from 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, there's a place downtown, 14th Factory, I think it's called.
Downtown Los Angeles.
Downtown Los Angeles, yeah. Yes.
Yes.
Or Factory 14. 14th uh-huh. Factory, Factory 14. But anyway, it's a really great... kind of an art installation of different works from different artists, and it's all a lot of it's kind of multimedia or video driven, but it's really a fascinating place, and it's totally worth the $15 to get in. Beyond this one, the centerpiece, the crown jewel of the place, for especially for film nerds, is a pretty faithful recreation of the kind of like what some people call the cosmic zoo. Bedroom from the end of 2001, where we see Dave Bowman kind of like live out his remaining days and then is reborn as a star child. So it's kind of like that white room with the white light coming up from the floor. It's really super accurate. Although I've had, like, I believe Darren Doctorman, our friend, has pointed out how it's there are some pretty big differences between like the art on the wall and things, but still the spirit of it is captured quite well. And he went down, and we all went down to get our pictures taken. And so I highly recommend. I don't know if it's still happening. I think it was going to go until the end of April. If it's still happening, I think you should definitely go. If not, well, it was a great photo op.
But it is. It's one of those things where it's like we almost want to live in these movie spaces. That we remember, like, I think this is one of the advantages of living in Los Angeles is every time I go through Union Station in downtown Los Angeles, I think about
Blade Runner,
yeah, because no problem. We're just doing a podcast. Thank it's you. Okay. Charlie just had his food delivered,
yes.
but like there's
so ask me a question right now as I take a big bite.
Yeah, perfectly. There's that. There's also of course that tunnel on the 110. Where you go through these series of tunnels, and that was, of course, one of the settings for Back to the Future 2. Is it Back to the Future 2?
I think the tunnel you're thinking about is actually up in Griffith Park.
Oh, okay.
Which is the same tunnel I was in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Right.
Which is nearby a location for Barton Fink, so it's kind of an old Hollywood-type location up there.
And there's another tunnel that was also in Blade Runner.
The Second Street Tunnel.
That's
in downtown,
okay.
Which is near the Bradbury Building.
Yes.
Yes.
Which was...
It all comes together there.
It does.
No, but look, if I ever get mega rich, I'm going to totally faithfully recreate Deckard's apartment from Blade Runner. I mean, I'm going to have everything. There's the tiles from the Ennis Brown house, the Frank Lloyd Wright tiles. I'm going to have the piano. I'm going to have the photos. I have some of the photos actually recreated from the real photos from the set, so I can do a pretty nice recreation. I would do like the balcony, and I'd have like a miniature LA out there with like spinners. I would dump so much money to create Deckard's apartment because I think it's one of the most amazing environments I've ever seen in a film where I just want to live there. I'd like to die there. It's a stupid like male fantasy bachelor geek dream that now that I'm engaged, there's no way in hell that's gonna happen. But I would love to like have that immersive environment. And there's a guy online, his name's Quentin. I forget his last name, but he's a super talented like computer designer artist, and he's created a really great VR Deckard apartment, which you can move and check out and go into the corners of. So,
well,
yes.
Speaking of Blade Runner, the rumor is that the Alamo Draft House in Los Angeles that they're currently building out will feature a Blade Runner themed bar. So I'm looking forward to that.
I heard there's gonna be like a Terminator vibe to the LA one. Is that true?
I hadn't heard that. I'd heard Blade Runner. Unless they've changed plans.
Yeah.
These are all rumors. I mean, gosh, you know, we know a couple people I'm sure we could ask.
Yeah, wasn't Tim League here?
We could have asked Tim League. Yeah, he was at our screening. But let's launch into it. And we're going to be doing another episode next week. We're kind of backlogged on movies to talk about. But this is going to be an abbreviated episode where we're going to discuss Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. I want to launch into it and get your opinion first, Anthony, because you actually sort of you went to a screening of you went to the Guardians of the Galaxy marathon where they showed the first movie and then they showed the second movie
and trailers.
Right.
Don't forget
right.
the trailers.
Right.
I haven't seen the first one in a long time, so I was really looking forward to doing the double feature. And the first one, I don't love it as much as other people do. I think it's a decent movie. But
it introduces a whole new section of the Marvel Universe, which is the cosmic realm.
To me, it feels like an Avengers movie, just with a different skin over it. A group of ragtag, you know, loners come together, and they're fighting something that comes out of the sky. I feel like I've seen that movie way too many times. Transformers.
Or for the most part, they're fighting a digital effect.
Yeah, exactly. I loved Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 because it broke away from that. It felt fresh and it felt new. It had a very Empire Strikes Back vibe where the characters kind of go off on their own adventures. They don't stay together as a team, so it was really interesting to see the dynamic between Rocket Raccoon and Yondu and Groot, and then see how Drax was interacting with the new character Mantis.
Mantis is my personal favorite.
I wonder why.
She was so great. She's so sort of sexy in like a socially awkward way. I love the antenna. I'm just saying I like Mantis. Can't I like Mantis?
Yeah, of course. One thing, though, there was this, I call it squee culture, where you get somebody who's hyper excited about something to the point where it's obnoxious. I had that in my ear the entire movie. Every time Baby Groot would show up on the screen, I would just hear, oh my God, it's Baby Groot! In my ear the entire movie. And you know what? Unless you're a robot living on the satellite of love, or you're one of the guys from Riff Tracks, which, you know, goes hand in hand, don't talk during the movie. You're not funny. Whatever you say is not going to be funny.
You need to go to a different movie theater because, you know, one of my favorites is the Arclight, or mm-hmm. ones that charge a little bit of a premium. They're a couple dollars more, but it really does sort of keep out people that aren't, you know, that don't go to the church of cinema. And I feel like what's great about those audiences is they're trained to shame or humiliate anyone that would impede on the experience of going to a film in a theater. I mean, I can't even think of like last time I was at an Arclight. Well, actually, no, I do remember the last time someone was talking a lot. It was someone I was with, but I'm not gonna recount that story.
Hey, if there was an Arclight close to where I live, which is, you know, Anaheim, I would go there all the time. Unfortunately, all we have is AMC. We had this really great theater called the Ultralux, which was at Garden Walk. I loved that theater. It had the same vibe. Like, nobody's going to be talking during the movie. Nobody's going to be, you know, irritating. And they got rid of it. That's where the new House of Blues is.
Well, let's get into talking about Guardians. I've seen it twice in 2D. But what's weird is I kind of feel like I'm missing out. I feel like this is a film, especially based on that opening sequence.
Yeah.
There's an opening sequence with a dancing Baby Groot, an action scene where I'm thinking, you know what? This actually would be better in 3D. Some of the cosmic special effects and spaceships and I don't want to give too much away. Some of the, you know, just weird cosmic stuff. It kind of felt a little influenced by Doctor Strange in the sense that the effects were just bizarre, over the top, something like we've never seen before. One of the great effects at the very beginning is a de-aged Kurt Russell in this opening scene where they go to a Dairy Queen. I mean, that was just so 70s and funny, and like it just, and it's such a short sequence, and you know, there's barely any dialogue. It's hilarious. And then of course it's like there's no getting the team or getting the band back together. They're together. I mean, they're on a mission in the very beginning.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, look, a lot of people have complained that it's like it's not better than the first one. I think it's hard to be fresh.
Personally, I thought it was better.
Well, I just think it's not. I think it's different, and I think that it's not what they wanted it to be. And I actually appreciated it for the fact that it was different.
Oh.
And now should we get into spoiler territory?
I don't know how deep you want to go into spoiler territory because the movie just came out.
Really?
Yeah. A couple of days ago. I mean,
all right,
Mr. Big Shot over here saw it like, what, a week ago?
No, I saw it like a few days before. Somehow they snuck me into a last minute screening.
The point is, I was supposed to go and you didn't invite me. You jerk. I'm heartbroken.
What? I had other things going on. My apologies. But
I
look,
forgive you.
I mean, there's so many great quotable lines of dialogue. The music works. The jokes land so well. I mean, they really need to get like James Gunn, which I'm told he looks at a lot of the Marvel scripts. He has to be saying, add this joke here. This would be better if this happened here. He really has it down, right? Like,
yeah, I mean,
in terms of the humor.
Yeah, another thing that I really enjoyed about this is watching the first Guardians of the Galaxy movie and knowing what I know about the comics, there wasn't a lot of crossover between the comics and the movie. The characters were different, they had different origins. But this one, they were digging deep into the well to bring up like Marvel lore. Like,
no,
we
no,
saw
oh
the
my
Watchers.
God. Oh my God, yeah.
We saw the original Guardians of the Galaxy.
Don't blink,
team.
You'll see the Hulk.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, it was really neat.
Yeah, if you're a comic nerd, like it's like Jack Kirby threw up on this movie.
It was,
you know, just visually speaking, it was incredible.
I loved it. I highly recommend it. Charlie, what did you think?
Charlie in the middle of his
burger. I just inhaled a hamburger while you guys were talking about that. Look, I had a very similar experience with Guardians 2 that I had with Guardians 1, which was I had a blast in the theater. I mean, it was so much fun.
But you're not going to make a Milano Guardians of the Galaxy room in your house. Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. But
if you used a black light, it would look like a Jackson Pollock painting.
So true. But no, I mean, it was so much fun, and it was just the intensity of the entertainment was like at 11 through the whole movie. I mean, there wasn't one, I think, really dead spot in the film. It was just nonstop either fun, comedy, or huge, bold excitement, or just epic battles. It was always big. Like, there was like very few delicate human moments, which there were for sure, but like, It was wrapped up in such high stakes throughout the whole film that I thought like I was really just like so wired watching this film. It was like I've never done cocaine in my life, but I feel like this was like some kind of cinematic cocaine was doing it.
That's a great way of putting it. Yeah. Cinematic cocaine.
Yeah. So I enjoyed it. I mean, it was a lot of fun. It's not the, for instance, I think there are other Marvel films that I feel like left a deeper scar, and I mean a good scar, like. For instance, Winter Soldier, I thought was a fantastic film that I've seen like 6 or 7 times because it takes the typical Marvel formula, but it tweaks it and goes a little darker, a little more psychological, a little more like 70s, you know, thriller, political thriller, which I love. This was just like full-blown, like cotton candy, as you say, Kirby vomited on the film. It's like, but in the greatest possible way, you know? It's so technicolor. It's so like just like eye candy, you know? I do wish there was, like, the one thing I was disappointed by with Guardians 2 was the post-credits scenes, like the little post-credits tags they do, usually set up something for the next film or another film of the future or open up the door to something bigger. And these kind of felt like very generic, like, kind of like germane to Guardians 2. Not what's coming next, not what the bigger world is, for the most part, I thought.
Well, I get the impression that James Gunn doesn't like the post-credit stuff, and I think Marvel, and this is just me kind of guessing, I think Marvel kind of pressured him into doing it, and I think he kind of broke down and said, fuck it, we'll do 5. So he wanted to do them like just as inconsequential as possible. There was one that did set up like what could possibly be the plot for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 or whatever they call it, but I wonder if that was mandated from Marvel. It felt just really different from the other ones.
Yeah.
As my mouth is full, I'm surprised like Jeff Goldblum wasn't in one of the new, you know, the post credits tags just to set up Thor. You know.
He's there in some sense.
He's there in the end credits, like dancing away, but he's not there as like a narrative tease of what's to come. I'm sorry. I love seeing Howard the Duck. Yeah. I love that he's coming back and he's on little small little baby steps. He's kind of coming back into the world. But that he had his own little bit in the movie and he was in the end credits. So it's kind of fun to see him back.
What I also loved about the film is just what really makes Guardians of the Galaxy is the character relationships. The character relationships are so well defined, and they went off in these like Drax has this thing with Mantis that's hilarious. You know, we have there's of course Peter and his father. It's not a secret that of course, you know, Peter Quill's dad is in the movie, played by Kurt Russell, Ego, the Living Planet, with probably the greatest, you know, father son playing catch scene since Field of Dreams. You know, of course, Groot and Rocket, you know, their relationship.
I'm just bummed there wasn't a scene with Stallone and Kurt Russell together so we could have a Tango and Cash reunion.
Oh, wow, yeah. That would have been cool. Like, but I remember buying Guardians of the Galaxy way back when it first came out, when it was the original team, mm-hmm. right? Where it wasn't Rocket and Groot and all that. It was something completely different, but it was still set in that weird universe. It was the Marvel, you know, cosmic universe, which I love. So What are we expecting for Guardians 3? Because Guardians 3 is going to come out after or before Infinity War, right? It's, I think after. I think it's going to be after.
Even after the second one?
I don't know about that. It's after the first Infinity War.
Well, of course, yeah. But they've shot their scenes for it already.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, spoiler alert, they set up Adam Warlock. And Adam Warlock is this cosmic deity that, you know, basically took down Thanos in the Infinity Gauntlet. Honestly, if I had to guess, and I'll check, I think we're going to have the Infinity War movie. And then I think we're going to have another Guardians of the Galaxy movie where they introduce Adam Warlock as a villain. And then Adam Warlock's going to play a major part in the resolution to the Infinity War storyline.
Well, shouldn't we check what the timeline is and the release dates of all
of
these?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and check.
I mean, we
I'll
should
go
check
ahead and
the
check,
release
Chris.
Dates. Because right, it was just announced that they were going to make it. I don't know if they, you know. And also, I hate this kind of speculating. I think that, you know, I prefer to go on facts rather than rumors. And that sounds crazy in the news these days. Let's go on facts as they announce them. But I mean, like, just... I'm so ecstatic that James Gunn did this. And also, as the proud owner of a Zune, for some reason I can't get my Zune to work, I was so excited that there's a Zune reference in the movie because I own a Zune. I have all the accessories. I kept it. And after I saw the film, I tried to, like, boot it up. It does not boot. I basically have a brick. But I'll probably end up selling it to some cosplayer that wants to use it for their costume, their Star-Lord costume.
I have a Mattel electronic football.
Oh,
game,
and I have the electronic football.
Yeah, so I was
happy
to see that.
About that. Yeah,
I was happy to see that in the film.
Yeah, electronic football and a Zune. It'll be your Star-Lord cosplay kit.
By the way, just you mentioned it earlier, but I cannot stop raving about how amazing the de-aging was on Kurt Russell.
Oh, that was incredible.
Marvel is 3 for 3 with, like, amazing de-aging. You know, between Michael Douglas and Ant-Man and Robert Downey Jr. in Civil War and now this. It's just like there's no reason now why you can't just bring back a younger version of a living actor. A little bit different with Peter Cushing in Rogue One. Like that's a taller
right.
order.
Yeah.
But the technique used, whatever Marvel is using, is phenomenal. It's like it's completely believable. I don't sit there deconstructing it like I did in Tron with Clue with young Jeff Bridges where I'm like, you know, that should have been, like, so amazing, and it felt like, oh, man, I am now completely taken out of the story because I'm scrutinizing this face, this uncanny valley face, whereas Marvel now has created 3 younger versions of much older actors, and I never once questioned it. I was just, like, enthralled by, like, how amazing it was.
Yeah, Michael Douglas looks like he walked off of the set of Wall Street in Ant-Man. It blew my mind.
I mean, and that really appeals to actors, too. You can make me young?
So, an update. James Gunn has clarified that Volume 3 of Guardians of the Galaxy will take place after Avengers 3 and 4.
That's what I thought. That makes a lot more sense. Because that also, it absolves him. Whatever happens over the course of those 2 movies, he can just go into Volume 3 clean, right?
I still
and just tell another story.
I still hope we see Adam Warlock go toe-to-toe with Thanos. That's what I want to see. As a kid who learned how to read by reading the Infinity Gauntlet, I want to see Adam Warlock in a Marvel movie sooner than Guardians of the Galaxy 3.
Cool. Okay. So I think we're all in agreement that Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 is a good time at the movies. Let's talk about what we just saw.
Charlie just vomited on the floor.
No.
That's bullshit. I did not vomit. I was chewing on a French fry. I started to choke on it, like John Hurt in Alien, right before the chestburster came out.
Yeah,
and then vomit because vomit seems like it's a negative thing, and I have nothing negative to say tonight.
Yes, precisely. Tonight. But let's talk about Alien Covenant. I went into this with high expectations. Because I am one of those people. I liked Prometheus. I did not despise it the way the rest of the world did, mainly because I think a lot of people have something against Damon Lindelof, you know, some justifiably so, because Lost was such a disappointment. But I liked Prometheus from the standpoint of that it asked compelling questions. I think it was elegant. The character of David, I love. It was, you know, attempted to answer questions from sorry, we're being waved at by some people here. Attempted to answer questions that if you had seen the original Alien in 1979 were fascinating to explore. I'm not sure we got the answers we wanted, but I like the way that Prometheus ended with we're going to go on a journey to find the engineers. And now we come to Alien Covenant. The setup is it's the crew of this ship, about 15 people on the crew of this ship, carrying 2,000 colonists to another planet to set up a colony. They're awakened because of an emergency on the ship 7 years too early, and hear a message that leads them to a planet. Upon arriving onto the planet, and what's weird is, should we get into spoiler territory? All right, F it. If you're listening to this, look, if you don't want to get into spoilers, listen to this after you see Alien Covenant. But what was weird is that James Franco's in this movie for all of like a minute. He must have shot for a day or two.
I kind of thought that was kind of funny.
I mean, he's in the prologue, which is on YouTube, longer than he is in Alien Covenant.
Yeah, his entire role in terms of like delivering any dialogue is essentially a video flashback. It's a video movie, like a FaceTime type of situation where it's just sort of like, yeah, it was sometime in the past. It's some kind of video memoir or some kind of memento or whatever. But he's actually not alive in the film.
Yeah.
I mean, he is maybe for like a few seconds, but he has far more to do in that that viral piece, that marketing piece, the prologue piece.
Well, it's interesting because those pieces are viral marketing, but they're so well done, they seem like they can be part of the movie. They did those actually for Prometheus as well.
Yeah.
I just think that they're incredibly well done.
Yeah, they are. I mean, they're very slick, and they're shot at the same time as a movie shot. So they have all the sets, they have all the actors, the ones for like, I mean, it began sort of with Prometheus, and it continued with, believe it or not, The Counselor, and then
right.
and then The Martian,
right?
And now this. So it is kind of like, it seems like it's a staple now, of kind of not only promoting the film, but then also giving audiences a glimpse into the story.
But let's go back to the story, because I have to say my favorite Alien movie is the one where they introduce all these really likable characters and then kill them off one by one. That's my favorite Alien movie.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, that's all the Alien movies.
It's definitely not all the Alien movies.
It's not definitely not all the Alien movies.
Yeah, there's a lot of unlikable characters in the Alien universe, and characters that you don't give a shit about.
Wait, in which? In Alien? In the original Alien?
No, not the original Alien.
Oh
my God, no.
Flip this table over and start a bar fight.
No, I'm talking about Alien 3, Alien Resurrection, and even Prometheus, to be honest.
You know, it's so weird to me, and this is not a slight on anybody, but it's just casting has changed quite a bit. The type of actors that are out there, the acting pool has changed quite a bit. You know, still a lot of talent out there, but when you look at the original Alien, and you look at a face like Harry Dean Stanton, or John Hurt, or Ian Holm, or Yaphet Kotto, or anyone in that film,
or Sigourney Weaver.
Well,
I mean,
they're all so unique, and they're all so like real, you know. And now, I think it's just the acting pool of all movies, of all of Hollywood, the way movies are cast, people are more attractive generally, and they're more just kind of like, I don't know, genetically engineered, it seems like. I mean, they're not, but it just feels like that is the casting sensibility. It's like everyone looks really good. They look kind of hot. Everyone's kind of sexy. They're not Harry Dean Stanton, you know? It's like they don't have that kind of beaten up, they've lived life type of feel to them.
Yeah, but in the first Alien movie, they're a construction crew. These are supposed to be...
They're not a construction crew. They're like space truckers. They're like they're shipping...
That's what I meant. Kind of a commercial frigate.
They're space truckers, and you know what? They probably voted for Space Trump.
I bet at least half of them did.
The crew of the Covenant, they're supposed to be the genetic tent pole to start this entire new civilization. So yeah, you want them to be handsome and gorgeous and stuff like that.
So it's kind of like a Aryan situation. Exactly. It's interesting because in the prologue short, you definitely get the sense like they're all couples. You know, it is like the Love Boat. And I don't get that at all in the film, in Covenant. It's like you don't get a sense these are couples, except for a couple. There's two or three pairings of people. But in the prologue, it literally feels like it's like Moonraker, you know, where they're all going up into space and everyone has like a partner and they're basically there to seed future generations. Whereas in Covenant, you have the rows and rows of the 2,000 people in hypersleep. And then beyond that, you've got embryos for who knows how many more. So it definitely seems like more of a mission to populate a colony. But the prologue thing makes it seem like it's like Love Boat, like it's couples hooking up and they've all found their partner. There's even a gay couple on board, which I didn't get a sense of that at all in the film.
Right.
I had no idea who the gay couple was in this film.
Yeah, well, they gloss over it pretty quickly. But so, like every alien movie, someone gets infected. We lose a couple characters in a slightly different way this time. And then... You know, some hero has to rise to the top. And in this, I don't know. I just, honestly, I really did not love the lead actress in the film. Just, she
was bland and boring.
She was just kind of bland. I mean, I don't know. There's something about, like, the alien films for me are Ellen Ripley. Ripley is, she's a badass. She is selfless. I hate to say there's like a sort of a major plot thing where they got to go down and rescue them. And I'm thinking like, you're putting the ship at risk. What, you know, you're putting the ship and 2,000 colonists at risk for a few people on the ground. I didn't understand that. Like, it's got to be like, look, it's too risky to come down and get you. We're going to continue our mission to go to a planet and colonize. I don't know. Like, is this something that's been lost in movies? Because to me, being heroic is about self-sacrifice. And there's no sense of self-sacrifice in a lot of these. At least, well, in Marvel films, you see that thread. But in almost no other movies is heroism portrayed that way. Certainly not in the Zack Snyder verse Superman, you know, that sort of the emo Superman that he created that I don't think anybody likes. I think even if you're a fan of the DC movies, you have to admit that Superman's character is flawed. They really just, that's the reason the DC universe is not taken in the way that the Marvel universe has.
I mean, look, I think in Alien, in the original Alien, Ripley's ascent to becoming the hero was really natural and organic. And it's just like she just happened to be third in line in the chain of command. So when it got to her, she said, okay, I'm going to do things differently and I'm going to be more practical. And I'm going to, you know, be kind of like far more on the ball versus Dallas, who's like, let's just go down and try to, you know, torch something we don't even know what it looks like at this point. And poor Brett just like walked into it. And Kane obviously didn't suspect what he was going to, you know, face. So Ripley, she had a logical progression to become the hero, and she owned it. She like really took control and kept control, I think, throughout all the films she was in. I mean, certainly the first three films. And she did it in such a way that I feel like we were rooting for her because she was human. She made mistakes, but she was a survivor. It wasn't so much she was a badass. Like, you know, 5 minutes in a power loader would make anyone look like a badass, right?
Yeah.
But I feel like she was a survivor. And in the new film, I kind of just, I didn't, the characters I connected with the most were David and Walter,
yeah.
You know, the two robots. And that was just because, you know, first of all, Michael Fassbender is a phenomenal actor, but they had a point and an arc to the story. They are, David is a creator, Walter is a creation, and the two have to like form their own way forward because they are brothers, but they're also now father and son in a way too.
Now, did Walter's accent bother you? That sort of nasal, American accent.
You're doing like a George Lucas accent right
now. Is that a George Lucas? Isn't George more like this?
I've heard a lot of people complain about his accent. I was fine with it, actually. It didn't really bother me too much. And,
yeah.
And you have to distinguish him from David. What annoys me as an alien uber geek is the naming convention of Ash in Alien, Bishop in Aliens, Call in Resurrection, David in Prometheus. We're going A, B, C, D, and then went to Walter. It's like someone missed the memo on like how we name robots in the Alien films.
It should have been something like Edward.
Edward, Edgar,
yeah.
Something.
Ah, they blew it.
They blew it. Flip the table over.
Oh, God.
Anyway, but I'm sure no one really cares because at some point you have to make your own movie.
Well, let's talk about there's a sequence when we're not going to get into too many spoilers here. Look, the movie's not out for a few weeks, so we're not going to talk in depth about probably the second half of the movie. But there's a moment where shit goes down. Where it was, that's the most exciting part of the movie, and I don't know that if there are any heights, the movie reaches any heights higher than that. That I'm talking about when we first see alien life forms appear, and the result of that. That sequence I thought was really well handled. That got to sort of the old school Alien that we love.
Yeah, I mean, I got to say, I really feel like. The first act and the third act were very traditional alien filmmaking storytelling. It's like it's kind of like what we're used to. The second act, I was super intrigued by. I was really fascinated by the second act. Everything in the engineer city,
mm-hmm.
and how things got to be. It ties into Prometheus, and that's when you really get into the whole sort of. Gods and monsters and creators and creations and all like kind of like the higher ideas that Prometheus was trying to go for, but people didn't seem to lock in on. They took a second shot at it in this, and I thought it was far more successful this time in terms of talking about gods, their creations, their relationships, and also again the relationship between Walter and David was, I thought, fascinating. I mean, some people were commenting how on it was like very homoerotic, especially the flute scene where one teaches the other how to play the flute. And I think that is maybe intriguing for some people, but I was just sort of genuinely impressed by their relationship and how that evolved into like a really interesting sort of like atypical alien chapter. We've not seen anything like that, I think, in any of the alien films. Whereas the first and third acts, we have. You know, we've seen variations of that.
Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I liked that we got answers in this film, and the answers, for the most part, were satisfying. I liked how they kind of connected the dots from everything from Prometheus to the classic Alien movies. Michael Fassbender was amazing in both of his parts. The accent didn't bother me. I actually kind of think it's odd that it bothered other people. But when they announced Prometheus originally, I was excited because it sounded like it was going to be different. It sounded like it was going to be this weird connective tissue that wasn't a retread. And I feel that Prometheus was kind of a retread in a way. And all the intriguing aspects of, like, we're going to get answers finally, we're going to know who the engineers are, they dropped the ball on that. And personally, I kind of hold Damon Lindelof responsible. I know him and J.J. Abrams like to have their mystery box. Fuck that mystery box. I hate it. I think it's lazy writing. I think, to me, when filmmakers do that or writers do that, it's just, we'll make it up later. We can't have a solid idea. We can't have a solid foundation right now because we're not clever enough. But it's like the kid in college who always put off his homework. That's what Prometheus felt like for me. So to finally get answers, I was probably about 80% satisfied with them. And I'll tell you why off the podcast, because it goes way into spoiler territory. But, man, like, when it got back into what we've seen, so like, in other Alien movies, I just tuned out automatically.
And that puts a button on that.
we're both staring off into space, like, how to follow that up.
Wow, how do we follow that one up?
But you know, I will say one thing. I appreciated how the film didn't ignore Prometheus. Like, not only didn't it not ignore it story-wise, but it was fun to see, like, the flashbacks to, you know, blonde David in the full Prometheus spacesuit. I love they brought some of the music back from Prometheus, because if you're a film score nut, this whole film is like Goldsmith Central. It's just like the alien. There's probably more alien Goldsmith alien theme in this film than there was in the 1979 film. But then they also brought back themes from Prometheus. So I thought it was a nice kind of... I mean, this whole film, in a way, is kind of an homage to all the Alien films. I mean, you can find a piece of all of them in here somewhere. There's a little bit of Alien 3. There's a little bit of Alien Resurrection. There's definitely aliens in there as well. I mean, even down to, like, the drop ship they take down. They have, like, the little, you know, the body harnesses and things. I mean, it's so right out of Aliens. So it is kind of a celebration, I think, of all the Alien films. Just, do you like that celebration? You know, do you like that kind of... In some ways, some people would call it fan service. Other people call it homage. Other people say, well, that's just the nature of the beast. It's just like, I don't know. I'm still too fresh on this film. And as you know, I have a deep investment in the Alien films as a fan. And then having also produced all that content for the Blu-rays, I feel like I really need to sit with this film for a while and think about it. But it is a true, valid installment in the Alien series. It's just how it fits with the rest, I'm not sure yet, because I feel like after Aliens, I knew how it fit. After Alien 3, I knew how it fit. Resurrection, I was like, well, it doesn't really fit, but it's kind of a new trilogy or a new set of movies that we're going to see. So this, to me, is like part of the post-Alien 3 universe, like an expanded universe in a way.
But where is this going? I mean, does this fit into... I mean, what you're saying... It kind of makes me think, is this what we're... Are we stuck in a nostalgia loop? In the sense that, like, our Star Wars movies are just like, I love X-Wings, I love TIE Fighters, you know? So we've got this... I mean, this is why I appreciate the Marvel movies. Whatever you think of them, the Marvel films are showing us something new. It's sort of the Star Wars for today's generation, but Star Wars is just all about nostalgia, and now this is nostalgia for the original Alien films.
Look, I think... If you look at what George Lucas had to face after the prequels, where he made the original trilogy, and then suddenly he's doing the prequel trilogy, and he wants to try something different, and then people react negatively to it, and he says, all right, well, screw it. I'm going to give you Attack of the Clones, which is a complete fan service, fan pandering movie. I'm sure Ridley, when he made Prometheus, he's like, I'm going to try something new. I'm not going to give you the same thing. And people are like, I'm not sure I like that. So here comes Covenant. Boom. I'm going to give you tons of what you think you like. So I don't know if there's a way to win. I do believe that there is a sweet spot, which is probably very hard to hit, where you create something that's faithful to the original film but covers new territory. And it's interesting because a lot of that has to do with kind of what I call continuity porn. Which is, like, if you give the fans certain geeky details, you can have your way with the story and characters. If you, so long as, like, the hypersleep pods match from movie to movie, so long as the Millennium Falcon looks correct from one movie to the next. It's like,
and
so
there's
long,
that little dipping bird on your navigation.
The little bobbing bird is back.
Yeah, bobbing bird.
If you give the fans the kind of surface detail and it's accurate, they will let you get away with character and story changes. But a lot of times, I think a lot of filmmakers just don't care about that level of detail. You know, so they'll do their own take on it. They'll say, like, it's bizarre when you go from the hypersleep chambers in Aliens, which are very well defined, to the ones in Alien 3, which are more true to the alien ones, right? They look more in tune with the first film. And that's because Fincher is more of a fan of Alien than Aliens, obviously. But as a fan, you're like, wait, how do the hypersleep chambers change from one movie to the next? You know, and it's like that type of thing that immediately throws fans off. And you might, as a filmmaker, think that's not important. And in the bigger picture, it's not important, but it automatically tells you, okay, I don't know if I trust this filmmaker because they're not paying attention to those details. If they were paying attention to those details, then you say, okay, you've won me. You've won my trust. You do whatever you like, take me on a new adventure. Like, that's what I believe.
One thing that comes to mind is the design of the xenomorphs. First Alien movie, you have the smoothness. Second one, you have the ridges. Third one, it kind of does a different creature. But Alien Resurrection is back to the smooth stuff, right?
No.
It was
Aliens is the only one with the ridged, ribbed heads.
Huh. I haven't seen Alien Resurrection in, like, years.
Yeah, no, all the rest go with a smooth head.
Okay.
But there are definitely major variations in other parts of the creature, and I gotta tell you, man, I mean, I for my money, they have never topped the original. The very first alien in Alien that
I completely agree.
That H.R. Giger like sculpted himself. It's never been topped. And I feel like part of that has to do with the alien was originally devised as a biomechanoid, right? So that's why it looks kind of like a cross between a living creature and car design. You know, it's like a living machine in a way. And that's why it's so alien, because we being organic carbon-based units, it's like we cannot, you know, relate to that. It's like it is alien. It's strange. Like, why does that even work, right? But that's why it was so great in the first film. Aliens came close to that, probably the closest of all the sequels, because they lost the smooth head, but it still had a really rigid, kind of like sharp mechanical look to it. Then in Alien 3 is when I think the creature started to look more and more organic and less biomechanoid. It was like definitely looking more like muscle and tendons and flesh, and not like this weird thing that I don't know what that is, you know.
Yeah.
And it's never gone back. I mean, and in the new film, in Covenant, the proportions and the overall kind of like the actor who played the alien in the first film, Badejo, I've been drinking. We're in a restaurant. Balaji Badejo was a very tall, lanky graphic art student. He was a Nigerian art student. And he had a unique physique, you know. And I believe they brought in an actor, a physical actor on this film, who had a very similar body as well. So it has that. But if you look at the details of it, it still seems like it's a living, breathing creature and not this weird biomechanoid thing that I don't know what that is, which is why it's alien, which is why it works. And ever since then, it's been a guy in a suit or a more animal looking like creature.
Well, I feel the same way about the Alien films as I do about the Godzilla films. It's like I prefer someone in a suit. I want to have it rooted in reality. Because I feel like, and this is, I think my issue with Marvel movies is Marvel doesn't really have, other than Loki, doesn't really have good villains in their films. Most of the villains in the Marvel universe are digital effects. It's not exciting, I think, for an actor to fight against a green screen. You know, So I think when you're what you're battling is a physical thing. I mean, I think one of the greatest villains in cinema is, you know, the Emperor in Star Wars, which was played by an actor, Ian McDiarmid, who, you know, one of the great castings where he plays the younger version of himself, but he's actually old enough now to play that because he had makeup on in the first one, which age makeup, and then so when they went back to make the prequels, he was appropriately aged. So I think you can't underestimate the power of an actor, a physical thing, a practical effect, what that means. I think we've gotten too caught up in, you know, digital will fix everything. It just doesn't work.
But here's the thing. It's like CG characters, digital effects, they are all great. I mean, they are our modern-day version of stop-motion animation and glass matte paintings. It's like it's just a new technique, and it gets better and better and better. The problem is it gives the filmmaker absolute freedom to do whatever they want. Whereas if you look at Jaws or Alien, they didn't have the freedom. They had a pretty wonky-looking costume or a pretty wonky-looking shark that they had to edit around and they had to keep mysterious.
But it made it was effective.
It was super
the
effective.
The editing made it effective.
Because that was so brilliant about the three barrels in Jaws. Like, they couldn't show the shark that much because it was fake-looking. So what they do, they brought the barrels in. So every time you see the barrels, you think, oh, there's the shark. I know the shark is there, and I'm scared shitless because it could come up at any time, but you're not taken out of the movie because you see, like, this fake-looking shark. Same with Alien. It's like Alien was a guy in a suit. Beautifully, artistically created suit, but the less you showed, the more was left in your imagination, and that made it far more frightening. In Covenant, you have the top, you know, state-of-the-art, top-of-the-line visual effects that can show now the alien walking around in broad daylight. No problem. It can do whatever you want it to do. And that, to me, sort of like, it makes me wonder, was it better to keep it in the shadows? But then you could also argue, I'm doing like both parts of the argument here. The other side of the argument is every kid from 10 to 50 has seen the alien by way of toy, sideshow, whatever. It's like Hot Toys, like whatever we want. We've seen the alien inside and out. It's like we know what it looks like. So there's no hiding it. so why show it? But I think that goes down to hiding the technique, and again, keeping it in the shadows makes it more mysterious because you don't know where it is. You don't know when it's going to pop up and kill you.
That's interesting that you say that kids have seen it. I mean, growing up, they had Aliens action figures right alongside Batman 1989 action figures, so I knew what the Alien was before I even had seen the movie.
And now you have Alien Funko Pops that make them Alien cute, like Baby Groot.
I think a way around that would be to constantly change the look of the, like, not change the look of the creature, but introduce different variations of the creature. Like, the one of the things that stood out for those action figures was there was all kinds of aliens, all kinds of colors. I like that idea, and they kind of do it a little bit in this movie, but I wish they would just go overboard where, you know, you have a flying alien and just, yeah.
No, I wish they wouldn't do that. I think that's a terrible idea.
You're a terrible idea.
It reminds me of, you referenced the toy store. It reminds me of, because I was a big fan of the, no surprise, 89 Tim Burton Batman, even though it was flawed. I remember the sculpt that they had for the Batman toys. I remember going into the toy store and seeing a wall of figures, and it was like Batman winged suit, Batman aqua suit. They just took the same mold, put it in different colors, but it was Michael Keaton's face, and it was a bunch of shitty ideas for bad Batman action figures, and I never want to see that again.
Okay, I get where you're coming from. I do. But, okay, maybe the flying alien was a bad
idea. That
guess.
Is a bad idea. You should not come up with ideas for toys.
But here's the thing. It's like there is a basis in the films to hybridize the alien. So like the dog alien or the oxen alien, if you've seen the assembly cut of Alien 3, gave them a different spin on the alien. So it's like it's basically the same design, but it moves with different characteristics. It runs fast like a dog.
And they never capitalized
on it. That's the one movie that really took advantage of that. And even then, it was sort of like still basically the alien. But and then there were some of those Aliens toys from the 80s or 90s where you had the bull alien and like the whatever. And I think back to like a film like Gremlins 2, ironically, where you saw these different like variations, the genetic splices of the Gremlins, right? So there's a there's like spider Gremlin, there's a flying Gremlin.
Well, there's a great Key and Peele sketch about Gremlins 2.
That's right.
That talks about it. It's in the movie, which is I love that. You should look that up on YouTube.
I think that there are probably other variations of the alien that you could probably get out of a different interspecies mix, but I think flying would be a little silly. I mean, I don't know how you make that work.
I drank a beer and it hit me a little bit too hard. That was the first thing that came to
but
mind.
But like, what other aliens would be? What other animals would be good, or what other life forms would be good for a mix with the alien?
I don't know. Like I love elephants. So the first thing that popped in mind was an alien hybrid with an elephant, and that is the stupidest thing I've ever thought
because
of.
No, that could take us back to the original.
This is why you're doing a podcast and you're not writing the new Alien movie.
No, but seriously, if you were to mix an alien with an elephant, that might take us back to the original space jockey from Alien, which
kind of looks like an elephant.
I'm sorry, it's like still like the little kid version of me who saw Alien opening day at the Egyptian. And saw that, you know, they had it on display in the Egyptian courtyard. They had the full-size Giger space jockey. And I think to myself, that thing was like this fossilized ancient creature that stood to be, you know, 18 feet tall, had an elephantine face. And then Prometheus changed all that. And it's like, I remember when I was documenting Prometheus, and I went into the art department, and this is like a year or 2 years before the film came out, and I saw art of these giant, like, Michelangelo, David sculpture, like humanoids. And I asked Arthur Max, the production designer, I said, Arthur, what are those? And he goes, oh, those are the engineers. And I thought, wait, you mean the space jockeys? He goes, yeah. And that took me like a long time. Like that took me quite a while to wrap my head around, we are not going to have these giant elephantine creatures. We're going to have basically giant, you know, godlike humans that put on an elephantine type suit. And fortunately, that's why when the film came out, I was well prepared. I was like prepared for a year in advance of like what they were going to look like. So I didn't freak out like a lot of other people did. But I get it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in this film, they kind of hint that there are experiments. I would have liked to see some of the actual results of those experiments, more so than we did in this movie. I think that was ripe for exploration.
Well, a couple of those little experiments were like very similar to the ones in Alien Resurrection. I thought in the clone lab.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Some of the bad experiments. I mean, they're really similar, which is why again I go back to, it is kind of a celebration of all the films in a way, because the lighting and look of the subterranean engineer, capital that we were in, reminded me a lot of Alien 3, like this kind of dark amber lit looking kind of like almost medieval gothic underground. But then you walk into this lab. Walt or David's lab, and you see like the bad experiments gone wrong, and it's like, wow, that's just right out of Alien Resurrection. Not, it wasn't like copying it, but it was sort of like it was an echo of that in a way, I thought.
Yeah, I definitely agree now that you've pointed that out. I didn't make that connection when I was watching the film. Like I said, I was more of like, we're gonna get different creatures, we're gonna get, that's all I want. Like I want them to do something else. Like I love the classic Xenomorph look, but just I want something else.
Another big influence on this film, by the way, is and it's only in like two or three scenes, but is Aphex Twin video "Come to Daddy" by Chris Cunningham. Have you guys seen that video?
No.
It was the video that was banned from MTV because it was so scary. Go home, look up Aphex Twin "Come to Daddy," and you'll see, like, Alien Covenant is a love letter to Aphex Twin's video that Chris Cunningham directed. Chris Cunningham is a director, super talented director, who I would love to see direct an Alien film. I could not think of a better director right now to direct an Alien film than Chris Cunningham. But he did a video that was very similar to the, like, I don't know if it's called the Neomorph or whatever, like the all white tall alien.
Yeah, the Neomorph.
The Neomorph is definitely an homage to this creature that is in this Aphex Twin video that you have to see.
Well, I think we've said it all.
We haven't even started. You're just sitting there nursing your beer. That's not even there anymore.
Yeah, that's true. I'm not nursing it anymore. It's gone. Yeah. But I just want to thank you for being on the show, Charlie. And it was fun running into you at the screening. I'm glad you came out with us after to record this show. Where can we find you on social media? This is how they end every podcast. This is when you know it's like to listen to a different podcast.
I'm on Twitter at Lazarica. That's Lazirika. Same on Instagram and then on Facebook. Just my full name. Just look me up.
And then Anthony
on Twitter at This Game Cheats.
And you know me, just that Chris Gore and everything, and Film Threat. On Film Threat is Film Threat and everything, Instagram and Twitter and all that. Thank you for listening. And one final thing we like to always say,
let's get out of here.
No, let's definitely get out of here.